Hello, I'm Andrew Finney, and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast, a podcast aimed at all nurses at all levels interested in any aspect of a research career. We hope you find this podcast useful and enjoy listening to it. Do listen right to the end, where myself and Eleanor Hovard deliver a summary, and do give us a rating, review us, and do press subscribe or follow wherever you listen to your podcasts. Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Nurse Researcher Podcast, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Professor Jane Code, who's a professor in children and family nursing at the Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences at Nottingham University, or the University of Nottingham. So great to have you with us today, Jane. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I don't know if you've heard the podcast before, but really this is about you and about your career as a researcher, predominantly a nurse researcher. So we always start the interviews by saying, tell us how and why you became a nurse.
Well, I'm kind of quirky in a way, in that my dad sort of bribed me into nursing, in that I had done a foundation in art and was working as a costume designer up in Yorkshire, and was really broke, to be honest. And he thought I'd always make a really good nurse. So he said to me, if I went nursing for a month, he would pay off all my debts. And I thought, oh, quid's in. And so I went nursing, and within a week, I rang him up and said, Dad, I need more money. And he said, you know, I need some money. And he said, why am I paying off your debts? I said, no, I need to buy books because I absolutely love it. And I've been a nurse ever since. And right from the outset, you know, I really enjoyed being a nurse and loved working with patients. And also because I did have this arts background, which we'll talk about, it brought into my research, I enjoyed that creativity of care. I don't think there's enough said about that. But I didn't have a science background. Obviously, I think I only had one A-level in science. And so I had to work really hard, Andrew, to actually, you know, get that science knowledge, which I was keen to do because I was, you know, loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's bizarre, really, how influential parents are in some of these interviews. And with everybody that we've interviewed in the professor series so far, it's either been inspired by a parent who was a nurse or guided by a parent who wanted you to be a nurse and vice versa. So I suppose you'd got that academic sense of something that you wanted to do, but perhaps it wasn't originally nursing. How did the two come together? How did it go from, well, I'm a nurse, but being able to sort of move into academia?
Well, I was working at Birmingham Children's Hospital as a ward sister, and I was starting to be interested in research. At that point, it was probably research around hand washing or oncology nursing, because I was an oncology isolation ward sister in Birmingham Children's Hospital. And I started to get myself involved in, you know, some of the research projects, largely led by medics. And they took me on board in their work, which was great. And a dietitian called Anita McDonald, who's a professor in Birmingham. And she was a dietitian and I loved her work. And I suddenly thought that actually I could bring my arts-based work into this research, because it dawned on me, or maybe I was a bit slow, but it dawned on me that actually children and young people were not really being asked in these research projects. It was largely other staff, or it was largely a scientific type experiment, or it was parents, you know, at best, but it was definitely not children and young people. And so I started to question that and think to myself, is there a way that we could, you know, capture children and young people's views? I didn't know the age of that. I didn't know the development of that at that stage. It was just a simple, you know, can we do it? And I approached somebody in Birmingham University who then encouraged me to come into a lecturing post. So I worked as a lecturer in what is now Birmingham City University, and then the University of Birmingham. And when I was in the University of Birmingham, I then made that more and more research. So I did do a successful education career, and I loved, you know, training and supporting the education of student nurses. But more and more days of my time started to be research around this area of asking children and young people their views.
Yeah.
And woof, there the art degree came in, because I was able to do it in an arts-based way, both qualitative and quantitative studies. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was that first project? So you were a ward sister, ward manager, you were saying, probably at that
sister,
stage?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So was it another degree in nursing, or was it higher than that when you first got into sort of nursing academics?
I had a degree in arts, I say, and then I did my registered general nursing and then my registered children's nursing in Birmingham. And then I did a BSc in nursing education. So as part of that, we did research as well as education certificates. And so that kind of got me in through the academic door. And then I did a number of master's modules and then transferred to a PhD, which I did, you know, I really enjoyed that. Yeah.
And
yeah
did
I did
that
that
feel?
Wolverhampton. My supervisor moved to Birmingham University, and in fact, she was my boss. That's Professor Colette Clifford. And but my actual PhD was registered in Wolverhampton. And loved doing that. I did that part-time over 4.5 years, whilst also keeping up my job as an educator and researcher in the University of Birmingham. Yeah.
And didn't it feel like a natural progression? Did it feel like something that you were ready for? Or did it feel like something where you were in this position where you're thinking, what have I let myself in for? Or there's more to this than I thought? Because people don't always recognise sometimes the difficulty of a PhD, and people don't always sometimes realise that they are capable of a PhD. So it goes both ways sometimes. How was it for you?
I didn't think I was capable. There's always a lacking of confidence, but I was curious. And also I had that fire in my belly stuff. I really wanted to find things out, and I was really curious, and I really wanted to make a difference to, then it became babies, children and young people's care. You know, and that was actually the, I suppose, the burning desire behind it all. And then when I was working in Birmingham University, an amazing opportunity came up, a research fellowship. And even though I lived in the West Midlands, I thought I have to go for this amazing opportunity, which was in Bristol. And it was a shared research fellowship between the University of the West of England and Bristol University, in a unique position. And it was a fellowship for 5 years, fully funded, 5 days a week. Yeah. And it was my dream job, because it was working in the Child and Adolescent Health Centre, Research Centre in Bristol. Yeah. And even though that meant driving, 3 days a week down to Bristol, I did it because I suppose I was ambitious, and I think of that as a positive word, because I was driven, but I was definitely curious. To do this work. At that point, I had my PhD, and I really wanted to do my postdoc career somewhere, working with researchers, amazing professors, learning from them, you know, learning the tap dance of research.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to take you back to the PhD just to ask the topic or the question, what was the PhD about?
Well, actually, it was nothing to do with paediatrics, although it was in effect, because it was about looking at nurse tutors as they became nurse lecturers in the university settings. But it was all around creativity in organisational cultures. So I looked at attributes of creativity and role. So it actually drew all the things together. It was kind of like one of those perfect storms where I was bringing in my education career, my arts background, my nursing background. And I was able to study a number of universities. It was such a privilege that they let me in to look at and meet the staff and interview the staff and survey the staff, doing a mixed methods approach.
Yeah.
And I was able to look at those that taught adult nursing or were more adult based, as well as those that did children's nursing. So although it wasn't actually a child health PhD, it had the inference of looking at child health lecturers.
And did you feel that that PhD was a sort of turning point in your career? Did it open doors?
Yes, it did, because you had a PhD, and that was It gave you those credentials that you'd studied to that level. But to be honest, it was afterwards. It was when I went to Bristol and consolidated that work. And even though it was a different sort of work in Bristol, because in Bristol I was doing participatory research, co-creation techniques, setting up and supporting projects and running my own projects and building a team and doing all those activities that researchers do at a senior level. It was good to have that knowledge. It was good to have that knowledge behind me. And I guess that gave me a confidence. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And it opens doors in the ways that it allows you to go for grants, postdoctoral fellowships, and those sorts of opportunities. But it certainly doesn't hand them to you on a plate, does it? They're still difficult to get.
No.
So where did your successes come as a postdoc?
I think my successes, I often think, is that I was a children's nurse, but and absolutely championing child health research in that model I've said, babies, children, young people and families. But I was prepared to go for other things. I don't want to say I was a chameleon as such, but I was prepared to take a risk and go for other things that weren't quite in that niche area. And I did that. You have to do that as in the sense of part of your research training, your postdoc research training, learning to write grants. But I did that because I wanted to get grants that then I could bring children into that platform.
Yeah.
Because they're often hidden.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was my way of entering that world of saying, actually, what about children? Or have we thought about life course? Have we thought about life course? A repeated message. So for me, that was what I did. So I survived and I hope have been successful. I think my income since 2014, so about 10, in the last 10 years, stands at about 10 million. So it's significant. But that was because I was prepared to take risks and go for other sorts of things that didn't initially look, I looked at and thought, well, that didn't fit me necessarily. And then I'd think, well, maybe it does. So I was prepared to be creative.
Yeah. And I suspect to some extent, it can be harder sometimes to do research involving children, not just funding, but the ethical side of things. So I'm sure there's been lots of hurdles that you've had to get over in order to work with children and develop your research in the way you wished it to.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things, I think one of the stories I probably can share with you, which I'm proud of, is that I was undertaking a large study and we were having some challenges at the ethics committee because they didn't really want us to interview children under 8 years old, even though the families did. And the families who were the stakeholders had said they wanted their children interviewed from age four. So we had this ethics committee saying no, and we had families, the stakeholders, saying yes, we need them interviewed, we need them to be part of this study. So we came to a compromise with the ethics committee to do from age six. But I also thought that it taught me, it made me think that actually, why had the ethics committee responded that way? And that was because I realized they had no training, any of them, in that committee on children. And then I realized it was a national issue that there was no children's ethics training. So I approached the National Research Ethics System and met and got to know somebody called Hugh Davies, who was this amazing pediatrician who ran the ethics part of the NRES. And so he and I, over a period of a year, developed a whole ethics training in terms of children and young people's ethics. And every committee had to have a member who represented children and young people on that, you know, for that committee. And they all came on the training. It was in person. These are pre-COVID days. It was in person. And they'd come to me to a meeting workshop in an area near you. So it was quite regional. And we delivered that a number of times around the country, that specific children and young people's ethics training for ethics reviewers. And I hope we made an impact in terms of the ethics. But that is one of the challenges that then I thought, well, okay, we've got this agreement age six, but actually, you know, put your money where your mouth is, Jane, and do something else about it. Take it one step higher. Take it to leadership. Take it to strategy. And that's what I did. And we're in very privileged positions as senior researchers, as nurses, aren't we?
Yeah.
So I wanted to do that. I hope that's a good story to show what I did, really.
Yeah, and a wonderful achievement, really, isn't it? It's a
Thank
sense.
you.
It's a sense that where the, where there was probably blockers, sometimes, sometimes we think, well, how do we bulldoze them down? But actually, what you did is you set the bar, didn't you? You changed the way that things worked. So a wonderful achievement, and
And
we,
wonderful that I've met this, Hugh Davis, because he was
yeah.
actually employed by NRES. So it was kind of kismet, it was kind of again another perfect storm. I was thinking, great. And so we went ahead and did that.
And I think we will have all have read something by Hugh Davis, haven't we? It's one of those names, isn't it? We've all read some of Hugh Davis's work. So again, another achievement, which probably leads on to something which is quite obvious now because of your clear leadership and research success. But how did the professorship come about?
The professorship originally, I applied for a job in Coventry. I live near Coventry in the West Midlands. And a post came up, and again, a bit of a champion thing, in that the post came up as a nurse in aging. And as we know, there is no nurse, there's no nurse qualification in aging. I think Coventry University were just, I'm not sure whether they understood that or whether they were trying to be entrepreneurial themselves. I never got to the bottom of it. And I looked at it and thought, well, do they mean an adult nurse or a learning disability nurse or a mental health, or do they mean a children's nurse? So I thought, I'm going to apply because we're all aging. And again, that's about taking a risk, isn't it? And I applied and got the job at Coventry University. And I was there for 6 years. And alongside that, I became one of the associate deans in Coventry University for health research. And then in 2019, 20, I then got my post in the University of Nottingham.
And why the transfer? So you'd got your prof at Coventry. Why the transfer to Nottingham?
Well, I decided to go skiing, actually, Andrew. I decided that I'd earned a skiing holiday. So I took a break and took 5 months off, skied for 4 months. I'm sure everyone listening to this was thinking this was like unbelievable behavior. But off we went, my husband and I, skiing for 4 months. And then I came back to the post in the University of Nottingham. They actually had approached me when I worked in Coventry, saying that they really wanted a children's research centre. We talked about that in broader concepts. Obviously, I had to apply and go through the processes, but they were very supportive of having a research centre. And since being at Nottingham, I've been able to set up a dedicated research centre known as CYPHR, which is Children and Young People's Health Research. And it's about 30 strong now of people all doing research around postnatal, babies, children and young people, families, and the staff who care for those group. And it's an interdisciplinary centre in the School of Health Sciences and the Faculty of Medicine, as you've just said. And I'm really very proud of that because it's a research centre which Nottingham invested into, which is fantastic, and they invested in a nurse. And there are very few nurses leading those kind of research centres for children's research. So that's.
So, I mean, it's very clear that the research success is there. There's clear leadership. How did that link into, because I see you now as a leader with the RCN, I see you as a leader with the Council of Deans and the Karen groups. So I don't know if you want to explain those to people, but when did the leadership roles come about? And was that the thing that you felt you wanted to really build on because you've got the research success, you've climbed all of the ladders on all of the appropriate steps. Was leadership the next thing for you?
Leadership began actually in Coventry University, and I actually met Dr. Joanne Cooper, who is one of our chief nurses in NHS England. And she was working in Nottingham at the time at the hospital and was a senior nurse there. And I met her and she influenced me. I'm not sure she knows this, so I hope she's listening. She influenced me in terms of clinical academic research. And it dawned on me, it all just came together that actually my PhD and my whole journey had been this accidental clinical academic researcher that I'd, in my PhD, I'd looked at theory and practice, I'd looked at clinical roles. In my own work, I had always tried to do clinical work, stay on the register, all of those things. And so when I was in Coventry and met Jo and started to work with her, she was in Nottingham, I was in Coventry, I then started to see that this was a really important career path. And so wanted to, in some way, I didn't know initially how I was going to do it, but influence that. I began to forge links with the Royal College of Nursing. I was already connected to the Children's Forum, but I started to do it in terms of research more. I began a secondment, which I still have, to University Hospital Coventry in Warwickshire, where I am part of the senior leadership for research. And they bought me out one day a week, something that the University of Nottingham still does. And I started to influence and develop programs in UHCW, that's what it's called, with the head of research there, Kerry Jones. Influenced by Jo Cooper, we all started to make these programs of what we were calling bronze, silver, gold. So in other words, pre-doctoral, doctoral, and post-doctoral kind of roots. And at that time, you know, we were getting more funding from Health Education England and more sort of notice in you know, the National Institute of Health Research, NIHR. So it was all sort of starting to align together, if that makes sense. When I got the post in Nottingham after my ski trip, my extended ski trip, I then continued that secondment, continued those roles, and started to go more and more to a group called the Clinical Academic Roles Implementation Network in the Council of Deans of Health. I was already in the Council of Deans of Health research group from having been a dean, but Karen, that's the acronym of it, as you mentioned, seemed to me to be a really good network to bring clinical academic research careers together for nurses, midwives, and allied health professionals. And I started attending those meetings. And then over time, I think about 2 years later, I became the chair, and I am currently the chair of CARIN. And that has given me leadership and leverage into other groups. Largely, they might be medically run, or Royal College of Nursing, or wherever, to actually champion clinical academic research careers and research. And so not only doing my research in the research centre, CYPHR, but actually, I really hope, Andrew, impacting on people's careers, you know, yeah. Nurses, midwives, and other health professionals, regionally, but nationally, and now internationally, which is wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm very proud of that.
Your work is definitely impactful and inspiring, and I think, you know, my own observations of you and your team when I've seen you at some of these conferences, there's a real research culture and a real culture to grow junior academics, to sort of bring them along, you know, in your path. What's left for Professor Jane Code, so we don't lose her too soon to skiing?
The skiing land, with skiing just about to be coming. I hope that in the new systems, because as we know, we've got the £30 million a year monies coming from NIHR, and I want to see that well spent and directed. I think there's an opportunity now for nurses and midwives and allied health professionals to really make our mark. But in order to do that, I think we have to be much more organised. I am aware there's going to be these 12 deaneries around England. And so I think that's the time for England to get coordinated. As chair of CARIN, I'm very conscious of the devolved countries, and I've started some work with the devolved countries around bringing Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland for them to share their platforms, because obviously they don't have NIHR funding, although they can access it through a partner in England.
Yeah.
So that's a real privilege. And we're also in CARIN starting to do some more work around inclusion and diversity, and thinking about underrepresentation, not only of in terms of ethnicity, but things like gender or where you live or what, you know, speciality you're in. So again, it's about that. I said earlier about being wanting to take risks. It's that sort of not a taking a risk, but it's that sort of thinking in a broader framework. You know, thinking, well, what does inclusion mean for us all?
Yeah.
So I'm starting to do some of that work as well, which, yeah, is great, very exciting. There's always a challenge, which I love.
There is, and it feels like our time. I said that in a recent interview with Ruth Endicott, with the money that's coming along. It feels like our time, nursing, midwives, allied health professions, to really start to get some equity and equality with research opportunity.
It does feel like our time. You're absolutely right. And also to get the same conditions as other professions have had, both in the, you know, the health service trusts, wherever those are, or primary care, but also the higher education institutions. Yeah. It does feel like our time. You're absolutely right.
And with everything that you've done, and it, even so far in a short interview like this, it's clear of everything that you've been able to achieve. What are you perhaps most proud of?
I'm most proud of some of the work I've actually done with children and young people in terms of their views now into tools and kits and services that you know that are around the country. And I'm also proud of whenever I meet a nurse that I've worked with or supported, and they say, oh, you know, part of my career or someone I manage. I absolutely love that I think I've hopefully been not only part of the group that I research and making a difference, but actually nurses themselves. And I hope midwives and allied health professionals now that I've, you know, gone into that world as well. But definitely those are the two things, if I'm allowed to.
Of course, of course.
So, like Desert Island Discs.
Yeah, I know. I know. I give you the works of Shakespeare as well.
Yeah.
But I suppose the difficult question perhaps for you to answer, because there's been such success and there's been a clear pathway of success for what you've done, is if you did have your time again to restart your research career, would you do anything differently?
The only thing I think I'd do differently is I'd be braver earlier. I think you asked me about the question about getting your PhD. I think I'd be braver before that now, because I think the opportunities are there to be braver. Mm. But for me, it took that career, that sort of route, as I said, Birmingham Children's Hospital, Birmingham City University, University of Birmingham, getting my PhD. I was really only brave postdoc when I went to Bristol. Mm. Actually now, if I had my time again, because of the opportunities out there, I'd go earlier. I'd do something earlier. Yeah. Because I think actually, and I think that's wonderful. I think that nurses are getting those career opportunities earlier if they want them. You know, reach out to people like me or you or Ruth Endicott or all these people. They're all there, and grab it while you can. And I would stay entrepreneurial-ish like I am, and I would stay that person that always tries to get around challenges. I love overcoming challenges. That would be a character I would have, but I would probably do it a bit earlier, to be honest.
Yeah. Understandably. And it's a hindsight thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
We look back and think that. you've probably alluded a little bit to my final question, but my thought is now, if I categorise these new awards that are coming out in this bronze, silver, gold that you've talked about, there's so much bridging, isn't there? And there's so many new awards and new opportunities to get on that research ladder for research delivery, research leadership, and all the things that we want nurses to be doing. So what advice would you offer that person who's now listening to this podcast thinking, well, you know, I'm early in my career, but research is something I'd like to be part of, or something I'd like to do? What advice would you be giving to that new nurse wanting to take on the research career?
Go for it, but don't do it in isolation. It's just a simple message. I would definitely seek out the people who can help you. And, you know, be prepared for developing your skills in a different way. So writing grants, getting them and not getting them is a skill. Writing for publication or going to a conference, putting in abstracts, and then not getting them through or getting them through. Those are really important resilience skills. And I think that that's a really important point, that if somebody's listening to this and they think, how do I get going? Find somebody local, connect up with them, network, and then go for things. But be prepared for success. successes and not failures. That I never think of them as failures. I think of them as, well, you've been rejected, but actually you think about putting it for something else.
Yeah.
Because you will get through that. You will get those chinks of light and you will get through. And for me, that was always the challenge of doing research. I always really enjoyed that. And yeah, you're always really cross and upset and everything. And you think, what could you have done better if you don't get something? But then I always think, well, what can I do with it now? Who can I go talk to? What else shall I do about this? What's the advice they've given me? Good advice this review has given me. How do I turn that to a positive? Yeah. That's what I would do if I was listening to this and I was early in my career.
Brilliant advice.
Yeah.
Professor Jane Coad, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me to do this today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. It was our pleasure. Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Research Podcast. And strangely, for the first time, I'm saying to the last episode of our professor series. So the last of this series of professors, and welcoming back Eleanor Hofford.
Hi, Andrew. It's exciting to think that you're at the end of this professor series.
It is. I think that 10, 11 episodes we did. We never had a number in mind, did we? We sort of said, let's see how this goes. And I think it's been more of a success than we anticipated. And absolutely. I've certainly enjoyed it. And probably, you know, a really profound and lovely final episode as well in Jane Coad. Mm. And I don't know Jane well. How well do you know Jane?
I don't know Jane particularly well, but I have met her a few times and getting to know her probably a little bit better the more our paths cross. But Jane tells such a curious story, doesn't she? I love listening to this. You know, taking her love for art and how she managed to intertwine that, I think, throughout her nursing and research career. It was really fascinating to hear about how she started out as a costume designer. And also, yet again, how parents sometimes play a role in influencing their children's career paths. I thought that was, you mentioned it yourself, I think. Did your parents influence you in becoming a nurse?
No, they didn't actually, but I've probably mentioned it with everybody else. Actually, it was relatives of my wife that encouraged me to do it. My brother-in-law was a nurse when I met my wife, and my mother-in-law trained as a nurse in the 1960s. So that was probably the influence to me. So yes, family to some extent, but not the same. It's slightly different with Jane, though, isn't it? She now, her father encouraged her to be a nurse by saying, "I'll pay off your debts." I should have perhaps asked, "How did you generate all the debt?" I suspect she probably having a wonderful time, but she gave me the impression of somebody that would have made a success of anything that they'd have chosen to do in life. Really, she's one of life's winners, isn't she? She's very determined, but with it, very, very welcoming, very enabling, and very supportive of others as well.
Yeah, it obviously ignited something, didn't it, when she had that experience, when she did, you know, try out the course. And I just loved how she described learning the tap dance of research. I've never heard it described like that before, but I thought, yes, she's right. You know, when you think about it, there are steps and there's skills and you have to develop. And at first you might be a bit slow, mightn't you, a bit clunky maybe as you practice, like with writing, and you get better and maybe you do become a bit braver as well, and certainly in most cases hopefully more confident. So I think it was a really good analogy, and of course you need a great teacher as well, don't you? You need supervisors who are going to be able to teach you those steps. So I loved that, and that, you know, she spoke of her ambition that's fueled her career, and about being driven as well. Despite thinking that initially she wasn't capable, but she certainly had that inner desire, you know, that fire in her belly, like she described, and became more capable as she learned more and developed her knowledge and skills. She did, what, 3 degrees, I think, didn't she? Art degree and then 2 different nursing degrees, and then master's, etc. And interesting as well how she spoke about taking risks and being brave. Professor Ruth Endicott as well, I think, mentioned those things. She'd taken a risk as well. And that being brave, I think, is something I think we've heard from some of our other, you know, outstanding professors of nursing research. It reminded me a bit of Brené Brown. I don't know if you ever listened to Brené Brown as well, the psychologist. She speaks about being brave and how important that is in leadership as well. So I thought that was a really interesting point. And especially that point for me, because I'm at PhD phase, when I get to that postdoc phase, how being brave was really important then when she took up that post in Bristol. You know, that was a bit of a risk, but actually was a really important risk for her in terms of her career development, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if you think of the last three people, Ruth and Parveen, they've all, you know, Ruth saying to her family, you know, if I put this in, we may be moving to Australia, and Parveen moving a family to the UK, and Jane really, really choosing to hop around universities to influence her career and to better her career and to be, you know, to be more of a leader in different areas and change the approach. I think for me as well, she seemed to rather than face the barriers, she sort of was able to trample them a little bit. She was able to say, well, if that's a barrier, I'll go out and do something about it.
Yeah.
You know, particularly the paediatric ethics and the work she did with Hugh Davies. You know, it's a remarkable success, isn't it, in story of the things that she's done. And I don't know, maybe she does. She's probably the person that hasn't had the time to reflect on this, really, the successes that she's had, you know, and the work with the RCN, the work with Karen through the Council of Deans. She's a real inspiration, I think, Jane is, and to meet her and her team, the team from Nottingham, you just get a sense that they bring new researchers through, that they work together, that they have an identity. And, you know, I've said that to some of my colleagues here at Keele, that we need an identity as nurse researchers. What are we going to be known for? As I'm supporting a colleague to really develop a culture here at my own school of nursing. And I think they are a real benchmark for people, the Nottingham team and Jane's work personally.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you just mentioned about how she shaped things through her influence and her leadership, you know, that point when she applied for the professorship post as well at Coventry University, that was a post nurse in aging, she said, and how she kind of influenced that to become, you know, what she thought it needed to be almost. And I think she made a point about when she became a senior nurse researcher, you know, that's obviously a very privileged position, but how to use that leadership then to create impact and influence. It's a real skill, isn't it? But she made it work. And I suppose with that, when you get to that point, you do develop more confidence, don't you? And you start to believe that you can make changes and maybe also question things a bit more as well. But it's almost having that creative vision. And maybe that's where her creative background came in quite useful as well, in that she could creatively see how that post might work in another way, as opposed to some people might think, well, this is an aging as in, you know, older people, but actually aging is a spectrum, isn't it?
Yeah.
So she saw that vision and she created it. So really, like you say, really inspiring to listen to Jane's story. And she's still, you know, still got so much that she's doing as well. And this, you know, this new children's young person's health research center she set up at Nottingham as well is remarkable, really, isn't it, in the amount of time, you know, when she actually set it up. So really exciting to hear that, how that develops. But being brave, again, really important tip, I think.
And risks. If she had her time again, she'd be brave earlier in her career, but I think she perhaps was anyway. I think she perhaps was anyway, and perhaps doesn't see that. It is hindsight that you'd go, but we'd all go and do something slightly differently.
I think so, yeah. And I guess as you get a little bit older as well, you do look back, don't you? Think, oh, well, I could have been more brave then, but I wasn't, because maybe life experience, I don't know. You know, it's just that point in life where you have other things going on. But when you look back, you think, oh, maybe I should have tried this sooner. Maybe I should have done my PhD earlier. But you know, things obviously worked out really well for Jane, didn't they?
And maybe with an arty background, an artistic background, you see the bigger picture, and she definitely saw that, and she went for it, didn't she? And I think with the people that we've interviewed, with a lot of them, they're probably are and I don't mean this in a negative way, they probably are coming to the ends of their careers. And that's what you'd expect with professors. Then that's not to say they don't have plenty of time left in the job. But you can't lose the skill set, and the longer that we keep hold of, you know, the people that we, the Julie Greens, the Liz Halcombs, the Gwenwyn Jones, Gina Higginbottom, the people that, the longer we keep hold of them, you know, and Jane and Ruth, the longer we keep hold of them, the better we are as a discipline, I think. And you almost feel that you need them almost as consultants, even if they retire from the post. You need that almost emeritus status with these people, and it gives you that sense of when they do choose to retire. And I do fear that Jane does the ski slopes are calling. I got that, but I'm hoping she can do that just in a recreational way rather than in a retirement way, because we still need these people in the profession. And this is the time now where we need their leadership more than ever, when we've got all of these awards and opportunities, and they need to be shaped right, and we need to be molding the people that are coming through.
Absolutely. You know, their expertise is invaluable, isn't it? But I mean, Jane still sounds like she's got plans, you know, with Karen as well, when she spoke about inclusion and diversity and focusing on underrepresented groups. So, you know, so much more. There's always something to do. There's always a challenge, isn't there?
We hope these people retire in stages, don't we?
So we can still speak to them. Absolutely.
Please, you know, say,
don't
say
go too far.
Yeah. Please retire over a 10-year period. This gives that opportunity to still chip in, you know, for the advice and the guidance. So another great episode. I think a wonderful episode to end the season on, and probably time for us as the final bit of this episode to just reflect on what has been a really valuable series, and some of the comments that we've both had on Twitter and some of the feedback that we've had. It's ticked the boxes that we'd hoped, I think.
I think so, Andrew, you know, more than just tick the boxes as well. I mean, I myself love listening to these stories and these experiences of these incredible nurse researchers. That are great role models for all of us, aren't they? And as more people listen to these stories and become inspired by them, I think, you know, it's becoming more engaging. We're getting more listeners. You're reaching an international audience as well.
We are,
aren't you? So that's really great. And without having this space to do that, you just don't, you know, have that understanding, do you, of the difficulties, the challenges, but the successes as well of some of these nurse researchers. So it's a really fantastic opportunity, I think, for other nurses and midwives and allied health professionals as well to listen to these stories of these exceptional nurse research leaders. So really well done. I think it's been brilliant.
You know, and you always say I, and it's a we, you know, we're very much a team. So I want to thank Pete Lonsdale for his editorial support. I definitely want to thank you for your co-hosting to some extent and summary of this, and to thank the people that have spoke to us as well, the people that have taken the time. We've probably got less than a 50. Yeah, if this was research, I probably had less than a 50% response rate in asking people who wanted to be interviewed. And these are very, very busy people, you know, at a very busy time for research. So taking time out to speak to us has been wonderful, and we will keep pestering as we go forward and look to do this. So I think time to announce that the next series, there will be a next series, will be in 2024, probably around February time. And our new series will be called the Clinical Academic Series.
Yeah, that's going to be really exciting and interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we needed people to understand the journey from the bottom to the top with professors. And as we're striving now for clinical academic roles in nursing, whether that's postdoc or not, or PhD or not, as we're striving for clinical academic roles, we perhaps need to hear from people that have done that successfully, because I'm sure their story won't be linear. I'm sure it will be, we had to do this, I had to do that, this is how I do it. Sometimes it feels like two jobs, other times I can bring it together as one role. And we need to see who's trailblazing in this area now, don't we? That's what we need to do.
It'd be really interesting to hear those stories. And thank you, Andrew, as well, you know, for your excellent interview skills and for giving me this opportunity as well to do the summaries and be part of this. It's really fantastic.
Well, we've been working together a couple of years now, haven't we, from separate institutions, really trying to support people with primary and community nursing backgrounds. But this has really widened it for us a little bit. I think the gaps in this first series have probably been mental health, learning disabilities, we didn't get the representation, and it wasn't for the want of trying. I did email some people, but we weren't able to get it over the line with regards to an interview. But I certainly think we should really be exploiting those fields of nursing in the next series, and trying to look at where we've got the clinical academics and mental health, learning disabilities, children's nursing, and as well as adult nursing, perhaps midwifery, if we can pull that in as well.
Yeah, there's some incredible opportunities, aren't there, for nurses and midwives, especially with the new NIHR investments that are coming up. So I think this is really well timed for people to listen to these inspiring stories and the journeys that people have been on. And that the impact, you know, the absolute impact that individuals like those in the Professor series have created.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the final people to thank are the listeners. We seem to have a strong contingent of core listeners. We don't have a huge spread yet, but we do have a good core of people who are listening regularly. So keep sharing, keep telling people about the podcast. They will remain on the different platforms for as long as time will be, I suspect, unless we chose to close it down. Thank you to those that are listening in different parts of the world. In this last week, we've had 10 listens in Ireland. Get ready for this one. 7 listens in Mogadishu in Somalia.
Wow.
4 in the United States, in Garland, Gainesville, and Iowa City. We've had 2 listens in Sweden this week. I'm not even going to try and pronounce those cities. Västerås, should I say, and Bandhagen, if I've said that right. And we've even had a listen in Canada this week. So for all of those people that are listening around the world, I never thought I'd say that, Eleanor. For all those people listening around the world, again, share the podcast to let your colleagues know and friends know that it would be interested in this, because it's a free podcast. There's no profit. We've never received any payment for this. We do this in our time, and the reward is, I think, knowing that it's got good reach and good significance for people. It's having an impact,
and you're inspiring others.
Yeah, that's what we want to do, don't we? And we're inspiring others through the stories of others, aren't we? It's not us, it's the work that other people have done to do this. We're simply the platform, and we enjoy doing it. So I'm going to wish everybody a wonderful Christmas for 2023. I think we can timestamp this final episode, and a really fruitful 2024, and we'll see you in February 2024, or you'll hear from us in February 2024 with our new Nurse Research and Podcast series for the Clinical Academic. So we'll see you then. It's bye-bye from me for now, and Eleanor.
Brilliant. Thanks, Andrew. And Happy New Year, everyone.
Yeah, Happy New Year, and see you in 2024. Thanks, Eleanor.
Thanks, Andrew.